Welcome to WAMC's Speaker's Corner. Today, we're re-airing an archival interview with WAMC's Alan Shartok and longtime WAMC board member Judy Grunberg. The popular businesswoman, arts leader, and longtime Columbia County resident died August 30th at age 86 after a battle with cancer.
Hi, this is Alan Shartok, and this is the second in our series called Agents of Change. This is a special group of people that we're trying to, well, get to talk about themselves a little bit so that we can see what it is that makes somebody who gives a great deal to our community tick. And with us today is a great friend of WAMC, Judy Grunberg. Now, Judy Grunberg is a woman who everybody in our area knows as a doer of good works. In the past session that we had with Morris or Marty Silverman, we were talking to a guy who had billions of dollars and was one of the first people, as we say, into leasing. But in this hour, we're going to be talking to a remarkable woman who has some money and who has made it work for an awful lot of people to the point that there's a committee that is being established to consider her for sainthood.
I'm already leaving the room.
She has done so many interesting things, from operating and owning a restaurant in Chatham, New York, that there is a sense that we have to think, why does she do and take on the projects that she takes on? And the list of them goes on and on and on. So, Judy, let me start with you by just getting a little bit of biography. Where were you born?
I was born in the middle of Manhattan, that little village down south.
Right. And you came from a family where your father was the breadwinner for the family, yes?
Yes, he was, yes.
What did he do?
Well, he was the chosen one in his family to take over his father's real estate business, which he didn't really love. He would have preferred to be a poet or a writer, but that was what he decided to do, and he was a responsible person, so he did.
And so he raised the family. How many of you were
just
there?
Me.
Is that right? Now, I know from a source that that you went to the prestigious Dalton School.
Yes, I did.
Yes, I did. I had a dance band.
I don't think it was as prestigious in those days. I don't think I'd be able to get in now if I tried to apply. But.
Well, let's put it this way. I had a dance band, and we played almost every Dalton dance.
Oh, you did?
Yes, and I know who was there. And the creme de la creme of New York society was there. Do you remember that at all?
I remember going to dances. That was a little
before. Do you remember being with people who had extraordinary wealth around you?
Oh, no. No, you know, that wasn't actually. My friends were all on the relative scale. We did not have a lot of money. I hung out with the arty intellectual types, the ones who were on scholarship.
Right. You know. And then from Dalton, you went
Bennington.
To Bennington, right. And Bennington also had a reputation for being artsy craftsy.
Right. Well, you know, that is really true. I think a little of that may have been unfounded. But I was there, you know, in those glorious days of the 50s when, you know, we had our classes in Barnes, we painted in Barnes, everything in Barnes, actually. And I had some really wonderful teachers. In fact, now that I think about it, having graduated as a painting and literature major, I think, you know, how did I get to be known as a philanthropist, which seems very funny. But I say, you know, I think part of it is, if I think of the word philanthropy in its true meaning, which I think means something like lover of mankind, then I can accept it. But otherwise, I find it difficult. You know, how did a girl from Bennington College who wanted to be a painter, you know, get to this point?
But I think your instincts are what, Mario Cuomo doesn't like labels, but your instincts are as a liberal, those of a liberal, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. If that means, you know, that I care a lot about people and what happens to them. And I think, you know, and I have this guilt sense, too, that probably I want to help other people because, you know, I'm very fortunate. And it's not even like I went to work, you know, 40 hours, 80 hours a week to earn every penny that I have. So part of it is the feeling that I really don't want to spend it on myself or on my own family.
Are you saying that, let me see if I get this, that it's not as, when you say it's not as if I work 40 hours a week, that you got it but you got it in a way that you yourself may feel you didn't particularly earn?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I think it's really, really is true. I mean, it isn't that I don't think that I've earned other things by doing other kinds of work, but I think a lot of it, it's like if you asked Mel Brooks, or if I were Mel Brooks, and you said, you know, what is the one driving force behind your philanthropic activities, I would say guilt. You know, I mean, that would be...
In the 2000-year-old woman.
Yeah. The 2000-year-old, maybe I get the 2000-year-old woman. Val, you know, I think it's guilt.
It's guilt.
But, yeah. I mean, it's true. But the other thing is it is more money than... I mean, it's not a huge lot of money, but it's certainly more money than I need because I have fairly simple tastes. So, you know, I don't go in for the things that cost a lot of money.
So somebody's sitting out there now and saying, come on, Alan, ask her the question. Ask her why isn't she like everybody else who has a lot of money and just wants to leave it to their children?
Well, for one thing, I think my children are going to manage just fine.
Do you think it's good for kids to have a lot of money?
No, I definitely do not. I do not. I think it's a big responsibility, and I think in a way it sometimes removes the incentive to do the work that you love and work very hard at it. Now, I know there are other instances in history. Take a guy like Matisse. He grew up in a very comfortable middle-class family, and I have no doubt that if he hadn't had the money, he might not have been able to say, okay, I'm just going to devote my life to painting, and look what, you know, he's done for the rest of us. So I think a lot of it depends on the individual person and on their commitment and focus and on their passion for what they do. But I think I've seen a lot of cases where people who have grown up with a lot of money without the responsibility of using it in a good way have fallen, you know, have had a lot of problems in overcoming that because they feel if they're going to make money, they have to make more money than they have or than they've inherited, you know, that it doesn't have any meaning. And what's the point of going out and getting an ordinary job that is only making so much when you have all this?
But, you know, you said having money is a big responsibility. And I often wonder about this. So let me see how I could put this, you know, sensitively, if it's possible. The beautiful woman who everybody wants to date. And after a while, she starts to think, do they want to know me because of my looks, or do they want to know me because of who I am, my inner being? When you said before that it's a big responsibility, it's almost sounded like a sort of plaintive wail, you know, to have that money. Does that ever happen to you that you worry that because you've been so kind to so many people, that you have to worry about that?
Well, you know, Alan, actually, as far as my being kind, we did not have a huge amount of money until, I would say, 5-6 years ago.
Really?
An influx of money, that is. I mean, we had, we did the usual thing. We gave to the local fire department and the local hospital, and we had a small amount. And it was just through really a very good business decision that my husband made, that he got involved in a company that was bought out, and there was, he bought shares at $3, convinced all his friends to buy shares at $3, and then accumulated shares as time went on. And finally,
More shares.
And finally the business was sold at, I think, $68 a share or something. So it was quite, you know, a lot of...
And there had been some splits in there, too.
And right? There had been, absolutely. And so, you know, that money, a lot of it went into the foundation, the family foundation. So
was the family foundation around?
Well, my father died in, 1976.
Mm-hmm.
And left some money to me, and Paul, who was very sort of creative with using money.
This is your husband, Paul, who was a very good architect and who a lot of people knew. And
right.
When WAMC mentioned that he had died on the air one night, all we heard from were hundreds of people pledging because of their love for him. I'll never forget it as long as I'll live. It was just astounding what happened.
That's really true, Alan. That was incredible. I remember I came back from the hospital, or maybe it was the next day after he died, and a friend of mine said, "Are you listening to the radio?" And I said, "No." They said, "Turn on the radio." And I just, you know, it's true. I think it was wonderful, the outpouring of affection for him.
In all my years of doing this, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen anything like it.
It was very moving to all this. Anyway, he really was masterful in deciding, you know, I mean, in forming this, the foundation, in my father's name.
Mm-hmm.
And it has become a family foundation. And it was, you know, relatively small, but we kept adding to it as the years went on. And I think it's a wonderful thing for my family because it brings us together to discuss those things which are important to us. And I think that if you are lucky enough to have a small amount of money or any amount, and you can try to convince your kids that it's really in their best interests to give a lot of it away or as much of it away as they see fit, then I think it's, and you start when they're young. That's the only thing you can do, I think, if you're fortunate enough to have money to not to somehow eliminate the downside of it, to eliminate the negative effects, because they can certainly happen. And we certainly know plenty of stories of people who grew up with money and who somehow lost their incentive to work hard and to focus and, even couldn't even find anything that was important for them to do. Which is strange because in a way, you know, you think that if you love to do something and it's the kind of thing that doesn't bring in much money, as we all know many people who are, let's say, incredibly gifted, let's say musicians or painters who all feel that they can never possibly earn the money because the culture doesn't take seriously these efforts as much. You know, they are not considered to be integral to the culture. Then what a liberty, you know, what freedom to be able to go have certain things taken care of and be able to go ahead and do your work. But there is a lot of guilt involved with that, you know, and you feel like, oh, this is really selfish. I'm going to hide myself in my studio and just paint, and I'm not out there in the world.
And your major was as a painter, right?
I was a painting major. I was, I am, I guess. Of course, who was it? Mary Wells Green, who said, if I were modest, I'd be perfect. I mean, I think that I am a gifted artist, but I've sort of been a non-practicing artist for a lot of my years. And I'm not really happy unless I'm doing something with my hands or building something or making something. And that's, I guess, the downside of sort of becoming a philanthropist or becoming known as a philanthropist. Oh, you know what? I never answered your question when you said, do you think that people think of you in a certain way or are you conflicted about,
are they coming on to you because of your money?
Oh, okay. What I was going to say was I lived in this community for, you know, over 30 years before I think anybody had any inkling that there was anything there in the bank. So, except maybe the banker, you know. So with my old friends, there's no problems at all, you know. I mean, I'm the same old Judy that I always was. My house is the same mess. I wear the same clothes. I mean, actually, they literally are the same clothes, most of them. A lot of them come from thrift shops.
And you love to dance.
And I love to dance. Yes, I mean, you know, that's... So I don't know, you know, I've had difficulty myself in accepting this sort of new persona that I have become. I mean, I'm not used to this at all. I'm not used to, you know, and it's so interesting to me. People who didn't know me 30 years ago, I mean, they'd see me at a party and they'd sort of say, oh, yeah, well, no, I don't think we've met. You know, and say, well, have you know Judy? No. And I know that they'd met me like 10 times before. Those same people are now, you know, very interested. So I know... Yeah. Oh, yeah, we never forgot. Yeah, we've known her for years. Oh, yeah, we're her best friend. You know? I mean, it's like having a restaurant. Everybody who comes in, you know, is a best friend of the owner. You know, they. Whatever.
Well, let's talk about the restaurant for a minute. How did that come to happen?
Oh, my God.
This is the Blue Plate restaurant in Chatham, right?
That's it. That's the very one.
So how did it happen?
Well, I mean, it's so crazy when I look back. Actually, when I look back on my whole life, it's crazy. Okay, well, there was this restaurant which Paul and I enjoyed eating in, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, called the Blue Plate, run by a wonderful young couple who had bought it, the building at auction from the previous people who had a restaurant called Hail Columbia.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Which had... it was very sad what happened. I mean, I think that they, you know, they had some misfortunes along the way, spent too much money, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, it ended up that this young couple bought it and turned it into a wonderful casual bistro, and Paul and I loved it. And you said, hey, you know, we were there like twice a week. Then, after 3 years of operation, they announced that they were going to sell it. And we were all of us who had depended on it for our, you know, sustenance for a few years were very sad. And, we kept hearing rumors it was going to be sold, it wasn't going to be sold, whatever, whatever. Then one day, and I remember exactly, it was July the 4th, that summer, which I think was 94. Anyway, we were supposed to be having a bocce party at our house. We have this wonderful bocce court that Paul built to specifications, and it was fabulous. And we were supposed to be having a bocce party, but it was pouring rain, and we were all huddled under the carport. And all of a sudden, I looked up, and I said... why don't we all buy the restaurant? famous last words. Well, to cut to the chase, what happened was, you know, this wonderful idea that I had that I was going to start have a cooperative in Chatham.
A cooperative restaurant.
A cooperative restaurant. I mean, in other words, I thought that everybody like us would just be dying to save this restaurant and would be willing to put a few $1,000s in to buy it, buy the building and buy the business, and that it would be a piece of cake. And then, you know, then we'd all go and hire a chef and a manager. But anyway, those things, you know, this is the kind of thing I used to think about, you know, when I was in my very young radical days, and I thought this would be so great. Anyway, well, it didn't really turn out. But it ended up that I did buy it. I bought it with a partner, and that kind of fizzled after a while. But then I decided, meanwhile, my husband's saying to me, "Are you crazy? Are you crazy? You know, why are you doing this? Do you need this?" And I, you know, you get to a certain point and you say, "I can't go back. I never got it the way I want it. So I've got to reopen it. I've got to, you know." So, and the thing is, people say to me, "Oh, God, you know, now you've realized your lifelong dream of owning a restaurant, of running a restaurant."
But this
I
said, was not,
"You're crazy."
Right. This was not your lifelong
never,
dream.
Never, never. You know, it's, well, I'd have to say that I had my parents, and my father especially, had a lot of friends who were restaurateurs in New York in the 50s, 40s and 50s. And I spent a good deal of time going out to eat with my family, although in those days, of course, you didn't have the variety, the ethnic variety that you now have mm-hmm. in the city. But still, you know, I did start learning about food. My mother did not cook, although she did boil a mean egg, 3-minute egg.
But your father...
But my father was a quite good cook. But
and he was,
know,
also, he was also an artsy craftsy to some degree, right?
I well, mean,
he
yes.
had seen himself so that his friends were the Heifetzes and others, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, we'll talk a little bit okay. about that later.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
We're running
got out of way, right? We'll
it
be goes, here all month.
It goes fast.
I know.
Go ahead.
So, yeah, but my father, you know, he in fact, I still have some recipes of his on little pieces of paper in my file somewhere. But he was a Sunday cook. I mean, a guy, you know, could do that in those days. You mm-hmm. know, he cooked when he wanted. He cooked mm-hmm. for his friends. He made his special sauce. This was not the day in, day out stuff that I did all my life with my family.
So who cooked?
We had a cook.
Mm-hmm.
I hesitate to admit this to the public, but we did have a
okay,
cook.
Okay, I'll
we
admit did, it. So did we.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, it's true. I guess it wasn't unusual.
No, not
days.
In those days.
It wasn't
in the 50s.
In those days,
yeah.
You know, I even had a governess. Oh, my God. It's my mother, bless her soul, was much more of a hands-on grandmother than she was a hands-on mother, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I did. So I didn't learn. And in fact, you know, I think I learned cooking later in self-defense. I mean, I didn't really turn out to be a good cook, which I would say that I developed a small reputation for being a pretty good cook. Mm-hmm. In all the days that Paul and I entertained it, I never let anybody do anything cook for me. I mean, you mm-hmm. know, I did everything, you know, from start to finish. But I didn't, I mean, I had some very big disasters in the beginning, like the first Thanksgiving turkey I cooked. I forgot to take out, you know, the little paper gizzards and
you and everybody else. But okay, now back to the restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
Have you been a hands-on owner? In other words, do you tell them what to do?
I tell as little as possible what to do. I am not, I have a wonderful, wonderful chef, Al Saliano, who is a dream. And he's been with me since... 5 weeks after we opened, he, mm-hmm. he came. And he's been absolutely wonderful. And I think one of the things I have learned is you can't control everything. I do not know how to cook in a restaurant. I consider myself an excellent cook, and I think I have, you know, very sensitive taste buds. But I do not, I'm not familiar with a restaurant system of cooking.
So how have you managed it?
Well, the menu is overseen by me. We discuss it. You know, nothing gets on the menu unless it's passed by me, and it's mm-hmm. either been tasted or we've had it at some previous time. I make suggestions, and we have discussions about it. But as long as I'm happy with it, I don't want to change. And I've also learned, though, that, you know, every particular chef has his or her way of working, and you got to leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's one of the hardest things, you know, in managing a business. And I have absolutely everybody who works in the restaurant is just a fabulous person.
Well, as somebody with liberal sensitivities, I hesitate to ask you this because running WAMC, I have similar problems, but it takes a while before you can get used to telling anybody or asking anybody to do anything, isn't it?
Well, it's true. It's true. But I have other people who are willing to tell people what to do. So I can just say, you know, I kind of sit back. Basically, people say, well, what exactly do you do? Well, what do I do is I worry a lot. I look at the numbers. I have these charts that that show me how we're doing compared to last year.
Well, how are you doing?
We're doing better than last year. And last year we did better than the year before.
Are you losing money?
Well, let's see. That's a sensitive issue. You know, when we started this, I thought one of my friends came in after we'd been open for a while, and he was leaving actually. He said to me, "God, the lamb was great." He said, "You know, you should charge more for the lamb." So I said to him, "You know what? I'll take $5 from you if you want to give it to
you
me."
Do you think you charge less money than other restaurants would because for that kind of fare? Because you want to ensure accessibility? Is this part of your liberalism?
Yes. You know, Alan, that's very interesting. I never thought of it as liberalism. Actually, I would say populism. No, I mean, I consider myself, I wanted, you know, I'm a local person. And I want the restaurant, yes, to be accessible to everybody. And I mean, somebody could come in, let's say, and eat a hamburger for $7.
Right.
And have a glass of beer, let's say, and maybe a cup of coffee or something. You can get out of there for maybe $10, $12. But then, on the other hand, I guess the sky's the limit if somebody wants a fancy bottle of wine and, you know, and one of the specials that's bound to be more. But I was holding the line for so long. I said, I don't want to see any item on this menu more than $19. Well, unfortunately, we had to go up to $20. Last year because land prices went, you know, through the roof.
Which is an interesting point, if I may interject, because many of our listeners will know that one of the great restaurants in our area was something called the Sheepherders Company.
Yes.
And it went under. I mean, I don't know that it went under, but it closed.
Yeah, sadly.
It was one of the two real good restaurants in the Chatham area, yours
right,
and it.
Right.
So the question is, did you see an upsurge in your business from the time it closed?
Well, interestingly, so many people have asked me that very question. I would say not particularly. They were wonderful to us. I loved having them there because, first of all, they send people to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because how many nights can you eat there at, you know, those high prices? And also people wanted to see the community, get a chance to go around Chatham and all that. So I think that they sent me many people. So their closing has, I don't think it's really affected the business. I think that the weekend that they closed, of course it did. Because there were people who expected
to
eat there
and
couldn't. And that was really, really true. You know, I really think, I feel about restaurants the way I do about, you know, let's say antique stores or bookstores or something like that. As long as they're not, you know, mall stores that all sell the same thing. But if you, the more you have, the more people who come.
In
your town, Great Barrington, people say, hey, you know, we have a choice of, I think, 60 or somebody told me.
Some incredible number of restaurants. Yeah. But, okay, so now you're a person who is well known to back Democratic large D as well as small D.
Yes, that is true.
So you're right there.
Basically out of the closet.
You're right there opposing the cement plant, you know, in the Hudson area and things like the Athens generating plant, and you're a leader of liberal causes. And so I have a question for you because I've been in there when the chairman of the Republican State Party, Bill Powers, has been in there with his wife.
My pal, Bill.
So do people come or not come because of your politics?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think you'd have to ask Mr. Chairman Powers.
Well, he's there, obviously not.
Well, I haven't seen him lately, actually. Hey, Bill, where are you? But actually, I don't know. You know, it's interesting. I thought about this for a while. For example, I have an event every year there that benefits Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood.
And I have been with you on those.
Right,
pages.
That's right. You were one of our honored guests. That is correct. At first, I thought, gee, am I going to have a problem with this? Because, you know, I mean, there are a lot of people who maybe are not happy with Planned Parenthood's stance. But then I thought, you know, maybe that's part of the freedom that one has when one isn't depending on certain things for one to for one's life. I have a certain freedom of being able to say, this is what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided the hell with it. You know, can I say that?
No, certainly.
Okay, I'll say it again, the hell with it. I say it's spinach, and I say the hell with it. And then once you do one thing, you say, hey, can I do this other thing? Yes, I can do this. And, you know, I actually respect people when I know where they stand.
We're talking to Judith Grunberg, just in case you've been driving along for 20 minutes and say, dummy,
who the hell is that?
Dummy, give her name. A doer of many, many good works. Okay, I'm going to name some stuff. You give me a response, okay?
Right.
I give you the initial TSL. You tell me what that's about.
Okay, that's Time Space Limited.
Right.
Time and Space Limited in Hudson. Am I supposed to tell you what first pops into my mind?
Sure.
No, okay. Fabulous space, community. all kinds of people gathering in these wonderful rooms. And actually, I had, that is where I had...
And not the most hotsy-totsy part of Hudson.
Not hotsy-totsy, no, no. Well, this is what I like, you know. This is a problem that I have. I'm very comfortable with all different kinds of people. But many of them, and in fact, most of them really don't have, are not highly cultivated or sophisticated, many of them. But we share a certain outlook, I think. And one of the things that TSL has done in Hudson is to bring a group of sort of seemingly disparate people together, but they seem to have a lot of very common spirit. I mean, this is interesting because I had a couple of shows there for last year and the year before called Close But Not Art, and then there was Close But Not Art,
meaning that you put together certain materials.
Yeah.
And I went, and it was very interesting. So you had old saws and... maybe not a saw, but
right.
Maybe
well, there were things that you couldn't, you weren't supposed to be able to really distinguish what they were. But right, they were not made to be art. But my point
close,
was
but not art.
Close but not art. But then the question mark, Alan, was an important aspect of the title because there was a question mark underneath, and that was, you know. But what excited me about this is that a lot of people came who don't usually think of themselves as the gallery going crowd, and had a lot of fun. You know, looking at stuff in a fresh way, and TSL's goals, which I completely support, are that, you know, you try to reach a wide audience, but with things that are really thought provoking. You know, look at something the way maybe you hadn't looked at it before, or listen to something that may be completely new, or look at that object, that this unidentifiable object, does it connect with you in any way? And I guess I'm so opinionated about art. This is one of the reasons where somebody once came to me and said, because the walls of the restaurant are completely empty except for that wonderful cartoon or drawing that Mark Rosenthal did that's for the previous owners, and it's still up there. But the walls are completely bare, and... this guy who has a gallery came to me one day and he said, "Can I curate your walls?" And I said, "Absolutely not." I said, "I don't sell food in your gallery, so I don't see why you should put your paintings on my walls."
Very popular in restaurants.
You know, it's really true. I mean, I've been to very few restaurants where there is nothing on the wall, and I stand here to say that there's nothing on my walls for a reason. You know that it's been
statement.
Yes.
Close but not art.
That, but you know, it's also that I feel. You know, there's a way of looking at things, and I got really excited by the idea of this show because it made me look at things in a completely new way and hope that I was communicating this to other people.
So, now, Judy, you've given these folks some money.
Yes, I have.
And for which I am sure they are eternally grateful, as is everybody else, you know, who does this with you. But they also have been very accessible to all, as you say, to all segments of that community.
Right, right.
There are a lot. They've done things for children. They've done things for older people. Right. It's really an extraordinary place, and it's pretty good.
Right.
And so let me move on from TSL, which everybody ought to get to if they're going to. If they're, you know, anywhere within the sound of our voice, going to Hudson and all the great antique shops and a village that has pulled itself up by the bootstraps, but I have to ask you this: they want to put a cement plant in Hudson,
yeah,
and you've opposed that rather vigorously.
Yes, I have.
In fact, you've even helped out with some of the people who are politically trying to oppose that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know where that passion comes from.
Oh, well, that's difficult. Actually, part of it is that I think that there's, connected with the plant at least, that there's been some sort of misinformation floating around. And it's not, you know... What I feel is sad is that many of us who are opposed to the plant are seen as being opposed to, let's say, industry and jobs,
mm-hmm.
and that I feel is unfortunate. I guess I'm opposed to it because I feel that we're being dictated to by a very large global corporation that is not, frankly, concerned about the well-being of people who live nearby, and I guess.
There's a sort of classism that develops. In other words, blue collars, people have been manipulated in your mind to sort of oppose the
opposition. Yes. Well, I think that is really true, and that I think that it's been to the benefit of the cement plant to try to divide the population in this way, mm-hmm. and that it has been very hard for, you know, so-called regular working people to come and take a stand against the plant because that is not what's expected mm-hmm. of them. And this is very difficult. And I know that for me, it hasn't taken very much courage to speak out because maybe people say, oh, you know, what does she care? You know, her kids aren't going to get jobs there. But the fact is that very few people's kids are going to get jobs there. And there are other
concerns.
There are other kinds of industries that will pollute far less and that I think would be much more appropriate for our particular area. That's the thing. And believe me, it's very difficult to get up and stand up there and say this is wrong, because a lot of people are going to impugn your motives and are going to think, you know, it doesn't affect her one way or the other. Why does she care? And so it's very hard, you know, to figure this out.
But you're afraid about the pollution.
Yes. And I think the other thing is that the more we find out about these large coal burning plants, the more they are of concern to us. And, you know, I'm concerned that in 20 or 30 years, we're going to look back and say, you know, we had this opportunity. We had an opportunity to halt the construction of this plant, especially on the scale that is being proposed, and we didn't take it. And I guess what bothers me the most now is you hear people talking about, we're having all this problem now because of some decision somebody made 20 years ago, or, you know, we're losing the forests because of, some things that happened a long time ago, but they don't think that a decision that they're making today is going to affect them or their families or their grandchildren sometime in the future. So, you know, we're unwilling to take responsibility now. We want to blame the people back then for having made the wrong decision. So I say, no, the buck stops here. We've got to make the right decision now. And that is kind of the way I'm thinking about this. I can't prove to anybody that, so many more people are going to be ill and die, because we know that every little contribution to particulate matter in the air is going to be of some harm. We have no way of dividing it or separating it or proving what comes from where. But today I heard on the news that that the restrictions now, the diesel emissions, are known to have caused a lot of serious problems in cities, and, you know, New York State may be considering cutting those standards to make them.
I heard that.
Did you hear that?
Judy, let me switch, because you are so interesting on all of this. We could talk about any of it.
Well, we can cut half of this out, Alan.
We're not going to cut any of it out. But I have to ask you very quickly about, let's go from the political to some of the artistic.
I'm on much safer ground there.
No, you're on great ground.
No, but I mean, that's at least something I know more about.
Columbia Festival Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
Well, it's an orchestra that was founded by Gwen Gould, who is now a full-time resident of the county, where there wasn't really a local orchestra, and they've been very successful particularly in their annual event at the Shaker Museum, the Salute to America concert, where they have performed music of American composers, many of them living, many of them having taken part in the concerts.
Haven't I heard them also in other venues like North Point in Kinderland?
Yes, they have been there. I think they've also been occasionally that maybe Sejiozawa Hall, mm-hmm. I think in other schools in the area.
Now, what's important about this, that it's local? And then it brings the arts to your locality?
Yes, I think so. And also that it is, I hope that eventually it can be made up of more members from the local community, mm-hmm. as opposed to bringing people, let's say, from New York.
Hired guns.
Although the New York people might not be so happy for me to say that.
Hired guns. But I hear you want to build them a hall.
Well, it's not just them. I wouldn't want that misunderstood. I want to build a performance space near the village for the performance of dance and music. There is no optimum space for...
This is the village of Chatham.
This is the village of Chatham. And actually, we actually own 100 acres of farmland outside the village.
I bought it
with the help of the foundation. With the idea... it's actually a double idea. I mean, there are various facets. One, my concern about the loss of large open spaces and farmland in our area, which has been increasing now for the last, 20 or 30 years. I mean, I've lived in Chatham for 35 years. I remember my husband, Paul, who was very active on the Zoning Board of Appeals for years, being concerned about this large acreage zoning, the fact that if you cut up all the land, even into large pieces, the only people who can afford it are going to be people who are very wealthy, who will put up huge palatial houses on it, but you will end up with no farmland. And so one of the ideas, as far as this project goes, is to conserve those 100 acres of farmland and to try to keep it the way in its natural form as much as possible. And on a piece of it, we will build this performance space, which will not be huge, but will be mean that music and dance will be accessible to the community and the wider community of the county. And in optimum space, not something that we're going to make do, but really with excellent acoustics and trying and blending it into the atmosphere, the orchard atmosphere.
Now, you're raising, I'm sorry, but you're raising money from others as well as you.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't pay for this all myself, but I
How
do
much will
intend.
It cost?
Well, I'm not sure now. We're working on it. It's going to be somewhere in the, let's say, from maybe $6 to $10 million, probably.
That's
when
a lot
it's
of money.
Finished. It is a lot of money. It's absolutely a lot of money.
Now I want
and
to ask.
I want you to know you heard it first here because I haven't really told this publicly. So.
But let me ask you something about that. That's so interesting. Again, we're talking to Judy Grunberg, one of my heroes, and a person whose generosity is fairly well known. So let me ask you this, Judy. I've heard. I don't know how to say this sensitively, but when you raise money. I've heard that it's easier to raise money if you're somebody who has participated actively giving money to other people. So that, for example, if you give money to a lot of other causes, which you do, do they kick in to help you when it's your turn?
Gee, I don't know, Alan, but I guess I'm going to find out. Well, fortunately, I didn't. This was not on the burner till maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and I knew it, and it didn't become a real possibility until maybe a year or so ago. Mm-hmm. So, I can honestly say that nobody can blame me. Let's put it this way or accuse me of self-serving. I gave money to other organizations.
They can blame you for everything, and will.
Well,
and
of course,
they blame me for everything. But
well,
will.
That's true. That's
but,
true. That's part of our
part of the
responsibility.
Deal.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So, but no, I'm getting at something here because I guess people are listening to this right now, who all have very good ideas, and they try to raise money, and they try to raise money in big chunks, mm-hmm. And what they find is that. There is in every community, whether it be the Berkshires or, the Hudson Valley, a group of people who are fortunate enough to have a little extra. Mm-hmm. And many of these people do sponsor various causes, either something at Tanglewood or something. And then they go out and they ask their friends for money. And I guess the question would be to you, who has been so kind to those people who have very little money, how do you get out of that? How do you get out of that sort of syndrome of the only people who can raise the money are the people who have the money?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know. I think what I'd like to do in this case, I'd like to get a little money from a lot of people. I mean, I know that's what everybody says. This is what people say in political campaigns. Hey, I'm going to get a dollar from, 500 million people or something.
But I got to spend $6 on the mailing.
So, I don't know. I mean, I'll come back next year or the year after and we can have this a repeat of this conversation because I'm not sure actually how I'm going to do it. I mean, I have never raised as much money as I may have to ask for this particular thing. I think what I'm willing to do, though, is my foundation will try to match what I can raise from the public or from, let's say, grant money from other foundations. Because, I understand, why should I go to somebody in some other community and say to them, hey, we want this place for our community, so you help pay? No, I mean, I think in a way, I want to make it easy for people in this community who are interested in helping to help somehow.
Okay, so let me give you you can be my advisor now, and I'll be yours.
Okay.
One of the prices for being outspoken politically for example, on, you know, you see it coming, politically on things like abortion, which you feel passionately about, and which I feel passionately about, and a woman's right to choose, is that there will be those who think of you as too controversial, for example, for government money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know darn well that projects far less worthy than WAMC have gotten a lot more money than we have because they play ball, because they shut up, and they because they, you know. And so now you're going to be faced with the fact that, I mean, they have said of Joe Bruno, who's been magnificent with people in the people of Troy and Rensselaer County, Republican majority leader, that if he puts one more thing in Rensselaer County, it's going to sink. And so, you know, it may be that because of your political stance, you may alienate some people who may not give you government money. What do you think about that?
It's true. That's all I can say. You're absolutely right. But I've never backed down on what I believed in. And I think that people are able to separate certain things and to think, you know, and may even be in the political interest of people who do not agree with me to be helpful, because this is something that is totally unpolitical. I mean, I see this, you know, music and dance. I mean, what's political about that? It's being able to give something to the back to the community, or give to the community, or provide for the children of the community an experience than they might otherwise never have. That cannot be political. So I would like to separate my own personal political views from these kinds of things. And I should think that those in power might be able to do the same. But on the other hand, if they can't, they can't. You know, that's all I can say. I can't change my political registration. I mean, my God, you know, and I certainly have voted for Republicans, but I cannot change my registration. You know, in fact, it's very rare that I've pulled all those levers on one line. But maybe it's because, you know, I grew up in the 40s in New York City. So that's, you know, and I know people who are lifelong Republicans who occasionally vote for Democrats. So, you know, we have to just try to separate these things. But I'm glad that you asked, because I know people, I knew the question is in people's minds.
Okay, so let me ask you about WAMC.
Oh, Alan, how can you ask about it? It's on every radio in my house. Well, what about, I think it's a great station, you know, and again,
Now, you're on our board. I think we should point that
out.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. Oh, that's right. I almost forgot.
No, I've got to say that.
But I wasn't forever. I was a listener for 20 years.
No, in fact, I had to beg you.
That's right. You did.
I had to beg you because the competition was after you also.
Oh, my gosh.
But you did the right thing. So when you're a board member, I hate to say this, but you've never meddled. You have never meddled. I have board members who have meddled.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing gets me crazier than when somebody tries to impose a political view or a program, you know, the rest of it. How does somebody who, you used the word philanthropist before, and I think that, how does somebody, because the worst thing that we have to contend with when we go to find big money from people is that they will give you the money, but then they will want their pound of flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes you very unusual. Now, the question I have for you is that a difficult thing for you to discipline yourself with?
Well, you know, I do not choose to go on boards unless I feel that I am in sympathy with the goals of the organization. I mean, it would be silly, you know, because I would be constantly fighting. So I have to be... Have I ever? No. But because I've been very cautious with those boards that I've gone on. But I have known people who have, and who have, you know, constant conflicts about this. But we also know, I mean, it's like appointing people to the Supreme Court. Well, not exactly. But I mean that if you're asked to be on a board, the board members or the chair or the executive director obviously thinks that you're going to be an asset and that you're going to sort of go along with the mission or goals of that organization.
But
now, sometimes you don't.
Yeah, what if you saw something you really didn't like?
Well, I would tell you. I would tell you. I mean, I think I've told you a couple things.
Mm-hmm.
Not for the
You didn't like a certain program.
Or, once. You know, if you ever threaten to take opera off, you know, I'll be right there, Alan, yelling about it, you know, with about principles. But no, you know, I think that you have to accept that everything isn't going to go the ideal, the way that you idealize. And that if in general, the general shape of the organization is something that you have sympathy for, that you have to hang in there and help them and, mm-hmm. and help to make things better. And you know, again, I say that I've occasionally been asked to be on a board where I felt that I couldn't give my 100% energy and commitment, and I can't do it because I tend to throw myself into things, and then, you know, and then it's sort of hard to get out later. So I'm very cautious before I make a decision. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to worry about this stage.
Do you have trouble saying no to people about not board membership so much as money? Because once the word gets out that you do give some money
right.
out, it seems to me the line has to be out the door.
Right. Tomorrow morning the phone's going to be ringing off the hook now. Yeah. Well, you know, I have to say no. First of all, as far as the foundation goes, it's not just me, it's a family. And it has to be a community decision. So that's very good. And that gets me off the hook or anybody else in the family who's approached. And, you know, because it's basically not my money. Mm-hmm. As far as personal donations, I'm getting a little bit better about that, you know. And it's hard, too, because when people know that you know, you're there, they do tend to ask. I get an awful lot of requests for things that I feel are not appropriate or for me, you know. Either as an individual or as a foundation. So it's definitely not hard.
It's not hard.
No.
You can look somebody in the eye and say no.
I can, yes. Yes, I can. I can. It's getting better. You know, the older you get, the easier it is to do that. Uh-huh. Because you say, the hell with it. You know, I've been here all these years and you know, people don't know me by now and you know, they just have to accept it, you know.
So tell all of us on the other end of this microphone. What are the best ways for people to ask people with money for their money?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, giving away the store. I have no idea.
It is a great question. What are the no-nos and what are the yes-yeses? Should we hire high-priced, you know, talent who do this to come to you, Judy Grunberg?
Well,
or should people come to you, you know, and write you a simple letter and say, you know, this is what it's for.
Well, I do not have millions and millions and millions, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm not, but I think if you're talking about somebody coming to me who wants help for their organization that is not the foundation, I mean, I would say that our foundation pretty much has given to the same things year after year. You know, we can't keep adding more and more things. And again, as I say, this major project in Chatham is going to take quite a lot of stuff. So I, you know, and the other thing that I've really cared about and that my family cares about is giving for a hospice to be built at Columbia Memorial Hospital,
which is in Hudson.
So you know, those two things are sort of major things. But I would think, you know, if people come to you who are familiar with giving and have given themselves, it's a little bit easier. So you're talking as colleagues and as equals. It's very hard when some, you know, young student who comes to you and asks you for a huge quantity of money for their organization. It's you know, it's hard to take them seriously, and you feel a little embarrassed and guilty because you know that they, you know, maybe they haven't been able to pay the rent in their apartment last month, or you know, they're not able to you know, eat a meal out or something. And so you feel, you know, sort of divulging to them or having them come to you and ask you for a fixed amount is awkward for everybody. So I think that it's peers asking peers is what works the best.
Mm-hmm. And so if you put a board together for an organization, you should probably, I mean, I've always resisted this, even though you're on our board. I mean, you are not here because of your money, believe it or not. You're here because of your vision. And I've always resisted that. But people tell me I'm nuts, that you should put people on your board who are well-heeled and who can go and ask other people for money for the organization. Am I wrong?
Well, yes. No, I mean, you are right, and the advisors are wrong. I have not, in the board that I built for this performance space, I did not give that consideration at all. The money aspect, absolutely. I mean, if some of them haven't and want to give it, that's fine, but that was absolutely not a priority.
There are going to be some very wealthy people who are listening to this conversation who are going to be real ticked off, at least at me, for saying, because, you know, this is a way of life in some communities, that the best healed serve on the boards. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of interlocking directorate between these major places, maybe the hospital, maybe the this, maybe the that, you know. Mm-hmm. And it almost sounds as if I'm either ungrateful or putting them down. But I would rather go for, and maybe WAMC has a beautiful thing in that its audience tends to pay the bills. And that mm-hmm. is not always true and can't be true with other organizations. But you're going to say.
Well, I think it depends completely on the nature of the organization. For example, if it's a social mm-hmm. service organization, mm-hmm. you can't expect the people who are most involved necessarily to be the ones with money. So, I mean, I think it's nice to have a... probably a combination of the two, if such a thing exists. But I now you may ask, well, supposing you go to somebody and you ask them for $500,000, and they say to you, well, I'd like a seat on your board. Well, it depends who it is. It might be somebody with great creative mm-hmm. vision that I hadn't talked to about this before, has all kinds of ideas and would be helpful, in which case I might say, sure, you know, join us. But it might be somebody who... does not have that, but who would like to see this thing happen in the community, and I wouldn't ask them. So, you know, it's hard to say.
But if somebody wanted to be on the WAMC board and started to tell you before they even asked how to change your news broadcasts and what orientations to take, you really wouldn't want to put them on your board.
Oh, well, of course not. No, of course not. Of course not. Yeah. It's completely different. This is a much more complex organization than, you know, than mine.
Yeah. Judy, we only have 4 minutes left.
My
unbelievable.
Mind. Right.
So tell me very quickly about Paul. I want to hear a little bit about him.
Oh, what a great guy. Well, we had 37 fascinating years together. I consider myself extremely lucky. Very, very hard to, I have, you know, it's very hard to find a guy that lives up to those high standards. It was very hard to live up to his standards, actually. He had very high standards for all of us.
He was intellectually really rigorous.
Well, yes. And also
And when you ate with him, he really tested you, as I can attest.
yes. Well, he just had an extraordinary mind. You know, it was as if he could look at every situation, every problem from a completely fresh point of view. And it's very funny because a lot of people, you know, would accuse him of being a radical to the mm-hmm. extreme. And other people would say, oh, my God, he's such a reactionary. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, you get that, you know. And anybody who has a creative mind, who is free from, you know, labeling themselves, seeing themselves in a particular role, has that. Because, you know, people can see in you what they want to see. But in any case, he really taught me a tremendous amount. I mean, it was we taught each other, because I think that we sort of supplemented each other or complemented mm-hmm. each other in our strengths. And a day doesn't pass, you know, that I don't think about him or think, gee, you know, what would he have done in this situation? Or, you know, I sometimes I think, well, it's a little freedom for me because he might be advising me not to do something, and I'd have to say, even about the restaurant, that the last year of his life, we ate almost every night in the restaurant. And, or I guess it was the last 6 months, and he loved it. I mean,
Even though he asked you what the hell you were doing when you bought it.
That's right. That's right. He finally realized, you know, and it was great for me because he could eat just exactly what he felt like when he felt like it. And I had tremendous admiration for even his telling me you're crazy, because I was crazy. I mean, he was right.
So.
But I had the nerve to go ahead.
So would he be proud of you in terms of what you did since he's died?
Oh, my goodness, I never thought of that. Well, I guess so, because he wanted me to live my life, you know, the best way I knew how. As I think I once told somebody, he we learned how to live together, you know. He sort of taught me how to live with him, and because we were both, I mean, we were not easy to get along with either one of us. But, you know, he also, I think, taught me how to live without him. So that was one of the great gifts.
But in terms of your giving the money away, which you've done.
Oh, in terms
of that.
Are
you happy
of
that?
Oh, I think so. Oh, absolutely. In fact, he once said to me about 6 months before he died, he said, you know, I think you and I should leave some money in our wills to build a concert hall. He actually said that.
Really?
And that's what made me think, you know, wow, I mean, we could do this, you know, when we're still alive, or when I'm still alive. You know, I knew that was something that he'd been thinking about, and I guess I decided that why say wait till one is dead to have one's money spread around, you know? I think it's exciting to be able to see the results of one's vision while one is still healthy enough and to enjoy it, you know, to enjoy them, I should say.
Well, you know, when we came in here, you said, how long is this going to go on for? And I said, 58 minutes. And you looked at me and said, basically, what are we going to do for 58 minutes? And the answer is that 58 minutes have now gone by. And I think everybody who's been listening has heard the words of a very remarkable woman who we all love here very much. And I can only say, Judy Grunberg, that you are so special and so unusual. And I know that the last person in the world who would understand that is you. And so what a joy to have you here with us and doing all that you're doing. And for everybody who has benefited, and we didn't begin to touch all of those who have, a very big thank you from all of us.
Oh, Alan, well, thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed this a lot more than I thought I was going to.
You've been listening to WAMC's Speaker's Corner, featuring an archival interview with WAMC's Alan Chartok and longtime WAMC board member Judy Grunberg. She died in August at age 86. There's more about her life at WAMC.org.